Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for December 18th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer. In this hour, we'll be reading National, Valley and State, and USA Today headlines. The first article is titled, Students' Sexual Abuse Claim Unearths a Web of Failures, written by Hannah Dreyfus. Reagan Hookham was 12 years old and in seventh grade when she first told school officials that her theater teacher, Patrick Power, grabbed her by the hips and touched her legs weekly. Now, 5 years later, she's preparing for college and still waiting for accountability for what happened. After her initial report, four other young female students came forward alleging Power touched them against their will in ways that made them feel uncomfortable, according to school records. In one handwritten account, a young student described having to pull myself away from him. Another student said she dropped out of his class when she saw the way he interacted with her classmates out of fear the same would happen to her. Five administrators from Chandler Unified School District were notified and tasked with handling the case, including some of the most senior officials in the district. Ryan Ridenour, then the athletic director and an assistant principal at Castile High School, where the incidents took place, led the investigation. None reported the allegations to police or state authorities, according to records from the Arizona State Board of Education. Instead, Castile administrators sent Power back to the classroom. He was instructed to teach from behind the desk and to limit his physical contact with students to repositioning them for curriculum purposes, according to statements he later made to police. Weeks later, after he returned to teaching, two more female students came forward with new claims against Power. The unwelcome touching, including waists and shoulders, continued, they said. One student reported Power had invited her to meet up with him at an off-campus gun show, according to school records. In March 2021, less than a year after starting the job, Power voluntarily resigned. Families received a letter the following week saying their theater teacher had retired. The situation could have ended there, but Hookham wanted accountability. In June 2021, she, alongside her parents, reported her allegations to the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. They also brought their complaint to the attention of the Arizona State Board of Education. In 2004, Hookham filed a civil lawsuit against Chandler Unified School District, Power, and multiple Chandler administrators, including the five whose cases came before the state board. In court filings, the administrators have denied all the allegations. The Board of Education commenced an investigation that has spanned nearly 4 years. That effort has had ripple effects, unearthing failures by administrators, police, state investigators, and board members to uphold safeguards that protect children in a timely manner. Power, in police reports and through a statement from his attorney, denies all the allegations. Of the five Chandler administrators involved, none has yet faced discipline for their actions. In fact, in the years since the case first came under scrutiny, only one current employee of the district remains under investigation. Among the other four administrators, one was cleared, one voluntarily resigned, one retired, and one was censured by the board for another matter completely. As taxpayer dollars continue to contribute to the legal defense for the Chandler administrators accused of wrongdoing, accountability grows more distant. And as the state board has retraced the facts of her case, Hookham's persistence has helped unearth another claim against Power involving an allegation of severe sexual harm against a student. For 5 years, I was gaslit into thinking what happened to me wasn't a big deal, Hukum said in an interview with the Arizona Republic. To find out there was another victim who was so badly hurt, but for some reason never once brought up in the investigations, has been validating but devastating. Prior to joining the Chandler Unified School District in the fall of 2020, Power taught theater at Sierra Linda High School, about 40 miles away across Metro Phoenix in the Tolson Union High School District. Less than a year after beginning the position, he unexpectedly quit, citing the commute and other inconveniences. Before he gave notice, Lauren Semkowski, an assistant principal and Power's supervisor, noticed something unusual, according to police reports. Female students began abruptly switching out of his class, seemingly without investigation. They randomly did not want anything to do with the class and asked to be removed from there, Semkowski later told police. But at the time, Semkowski seemingly did not inquire further. Public records indicate she made no attempt to let Chandler administrators know about what she observed. Instead, when the Chandler School District reached out to her as a professional reference for Power, she gave a glowing recommendation. He has vast experience and is willing to put in long hours for students, Semkowski wrote in a formal recommendation letter for Power dated September 14, 2020. Some of our students who have never performed before found talents that they never knew they had. It gives me chills to think about some of the performances and confidence it produced in our students. Semkowski did not respond to a request for comment. Bianca Martinez, a high school senior and teaching assistant for Power in Tolson, knew why girls started transferring out of Power's class. Power was known for making sexually charged comments that put her and other students on edge, she said. Students at Chandler have since come forward with similar allegations. In an interview with the Republic, she recalled one instance while staging a Shakespeare play when Power insisted that she act alongside her female classmate, even though Martinez usually worked behind the scenes as the stage manager. We thought it was going to be like super innocent, but then he started describing how the scene was actually incredibly sexual. He wanted me and my friend to get really close to each other's faces, Martinez said. Then he started going into detail about the feeling of being turned down and how to be sexual in the scene. That's when I told him, I don't feel comfortable with this. I don't want to be a part of this anymore. She stopped working in his classroom shortly thereafter. Powers did not cross her mind until April 2022, when she received a call from a Phoenix police detective. A former classmate had told police that Powell raped her, and police had opened an investigation. That's when I started to feel really, really bad that I hadn't said anything, Martinez said. According to police records, a former student of Powers from Sierra Linda High School had come forward to a school social worker. The Republic does not name victims of sexual assault without their consent. The student claimed Power had sexually assaulted her when she was 15 by luring her into a storage unit of the theater room under the pretense of helping him pick up paint. Though she could not remember the exact date of the incident, she said the assault took place sometime between January and March 2020. She's been holding what happened that day for 2 years, she told police. sharing details only with her psychiatrist. She told the school social worker that she decided at last to come forward because she was having recurrent nightmares about the incident. She was also struggling with anxiety, depression, and self-harm. Her father and Semkowski both told police they believed there were other victims. In 2022, while criminal investigations were still underway, Power voluntarily surrendered his teaching license. Power, via his attorney, continues to defend his teaching legacy. Mr. Power is profoundly saddened by the allegations made against him, and he vehemently denies them, Travis Jensen, Power's attorney, said in a statement to the Republic. The statement went on to note Power's over 30 years of service as an educator, during which time he exemplified the highest of standards. In April 2023, the Maricopa County Attorney's Office decided not to prosecute Power for the allegations in Chandler because his behavior did not amount to a crime under Arizona statutes. County Attorney Rachel Mitchell wrote in a letter that the decision could be reconsidered if information about other victims arose. The investigation into Power's actions in the Tolson District is ongoing, according to police records. Now, the Arizona State Board of Education is investigating the Tolson District's handling of the situation, the Arizona Republic has learned. Joseph Ortiz, a spokesperson for Tolson Union High School District, said the district is aware of the ongoing investigation into Semkowski, but is unable to comment out of respect for the investigative process and to assure its integrity. In the Chandler District, Hukum started attending Castile in the fall of 2021, excited to be back in the classroom with her peers after the COVID-19 pandemic. I felt so grown up, like this was finally my moment to start becoming the woman I wanted to be, she said, reflecting on her preteen self. She chose Power's afternoon theater class as an elective, thinking it would give her an opportunity to overcome her fear of public speaking. I had no idea I was going to be groomed or that what would follow would shape the next many years of my life, she said. The next article is titled, Trump Extends Travel Ban, Adds More Countries, written by Zach Wichter. President Donald Trump expanded his administration's ban on some foreign visitors on December 16th, signing a proclamation that extended the existing ban on 12 countries and added others to the list. The White House, in a news release announcing the update, said the restrictions are aimed at preventing foreign nationals from entering the country if American officials don't have sufficient information about their background, along with other foreign policy goals. Trump has campaigned on sweeping immigration crackdowns in the United States, and other travel restrictions were a cornerstone of his first term. The December 16th move banned students from Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, South Sudan, Syria, and travelers with documents issued by the Palestinian Authority. Additionally, nationals holding passports from the following 15 countries are now restricted from entering the United States: Angola, Antigua and Barbuda, Benin, Cote d'Ivoire, Dominica, Gabon, the Gambia, Malawi, Mauritania, Nigeria, Senegal, Tasmania, Tonga, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. The White House said the expanded ban goes into effect January 1st. Laos and Sierra Leone, which previously were subject only to a partial ban, have now also been added to the list for the full ban. Burundi, Cuba, Togo, and Venezuela continue to face partial restrictions. Turkmenistan, which faced restrictions under Trump's previous travel ban, has been removed from the list. The 12 countries that were originally subject to the travel ban continue to face the same restrictions. Afghanistan, Chad, Republic of the Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Eritrea, Haiti, Iran, Libya, Myanmar, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. The White House outlined its reasons for the additional restrictions and changes, citing improper vetting, terrorist groups operating in some of the listed countries, or a high rate of their citizens overstaying visas in the United States. The updated proclamation includes exceptions for lawful permanent residents, existing visa holders, certain visa categories like athletes and diplomats, and individuals whose entry serves U.S. national interests, but it adds new restrictions on family-based immigrant visa carve-outs. When Trump enacted the previous ban over the summer, experts told USA Today that it would likely introduce complications for existing visa holders and could make re-entry more difficult. It's also likely to make it harder for applicants from those countries to obtain new visas. Individuals from the affected countries who have already purchased tickets to travel to the United States should consult with their airlines and the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate. While some exceptions exist, most travelers from the fully banned countries are expected to be denied entry. Those from partially restricted countries may still be allowed to travel, subject to additional screening requirements. The next article is titled, Community Rallies in Support of Mechanic, written by David Ulloa. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement detained a Sunny Slope mechanic after he was booked into a Maricopa County jail for misdemeanor charges of registering a vehicle in a different county to avoid emissions testing. Since his August 27th detention, Balbino Mayora, 43 years old, has been described as a pillar of the community by his fiancée, Davina Mays, and friends have delivered an outpouring of support for him on social media. More than $12,000 was raised by friends, family, and customers who Mayora helped in the more than 20 years he has been in the United States. Mays told the Republic on December 17th that U.S. authorities had deported Mayora within the past 48 hours, but other details remain unclear. Sadly, Balbino was deported yesterday morning around 1 a.m., Mays said in a December 17th text message. After the judge gave strict orders to keep him here until December 22nd. But both good and bad, he's finally out of hell and we can start a new chapter, she wrote. Mayora, an undocumented Mexican immigrant, is the owner of Balbino's garage and the father of two U.S. citizens. He was charged August 26th with five counts of registering a vehicle in a county different from his permanent address to avoid emissions testing, according to court documents obtained by the Arizona Republic. ICE took Mayora into custody August 27th after his release from the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. Fernando Burgos, an ICE Enforcement and Removal Operations spokesperson, said in a written statement, ICE works closely with local law enforcement agencies and routinely places a detainer on those aliens who are in the United States illegally or whose criminal history may otherwise render them subject to removal from the United States, Burgos said. Mayorga would remain in ICE custody until the completion of his immigration proceedings, Burgos said. Mayorga is so loved by the neighborhood that he has been jokingly teased by many, many people that he should be mayor of Sunny Slope, Mays said. If you were to go to any restaurant, any neighborhood, you could go to the guy two doors down. You can go around the corner. You can go any mile within Sunny Slope. And I would be willing to bet if you walked in and asked, who is Balbino Mayorga? They're going to speak nothing but about the love that he has and the compassion that he has for people, Mays said. Under Arizona State Law 28215-2A, it is illegal for a person to register their vehicle in a county different from the county where they maintain permanent and actual address. It is also illegal for a person to register their vehicle at a place within the county that is outside the vehicle emissions control area with intent to evade emissions testing, according to Arizona Revised Statutes 28-2152A. Anyone who is found guilty of violating this law faces a fine no more than $100 and a Class II misdemeanor, according to state law. Mayorga was arrested and booked August 26th into a Maricopa County jail on 5 counts of violating that state law, according to court documents. When Mayorga was arrested, he had his cars registered to an address in Yuma, Mays said. Mayorga was supposed to be arraigned September 24th, but he was transferred to ICE custody on August 27th, according to court documents and Burgos's statements. The Arizona Republic reached out to Mayorga's attorney, Bruno Gitnacht, to independently confirm the details of how Mayorga came to the United States and his immigration status while he lived in the country, but he declined to comment because the case is pending. The Republic spoke with Mayorga over the phone from the Eloy Detention Center. Mayorga said he was 19 when he left his hometown of Tierra Blanca, a small ranching community in the Mexican state of Veracruz, for the United States. He came through the Nogales port of entry with a Mexican passport and a 7-month tourist visa. According to the United States Department of State, people who enter the country on a B1, B2 visa, also known as a visitor's visa, are not allowed to accept employment or work in the United States. Mayorga worked as an independent contractor and filed a 1099 tax form when he was in the United States, Mayorga said. When he was arrested, he said he had overstayed his visa. Mayorga said he knew he was undocumented, but he did not give his expired visa much thought, because he became comfortable living the dream of making a better life for himself in the United States. Mayorga remains in ICE custody at the Eloy Detention Center as of December 12th, according to the ICE website. Mayorga was denied bond by an immigration judge on December 10th because he had cars registered in Williams and was considered a flight risk, Mays said. He had corrected the address on his vehicle registrations before his bond appearing, Mays said. As Mays spoke with the Republic on September 3rd, several supporters of Mayorga came to drop off envelopes for his legal fundraiser. With vehicles ranging from an old Harley-Davidson bike to a right-hand drive SUV from Japan lining the garage and the parking lot nearby, Mays said Mayorga had a passion for cars. but it is shocking how many people come to him just for his support and for him to be there for them. He's willing to literally give the shirt off his back to anybody, Mays said. There have been many instances when Mayorga dropped what he was working on at his shop just to go help someone in his community, Mays said. The donations for Mayorga's legal fundraisers have ranged from $20 to $1,000. Even customers who were strong supporters of President Donald Trump, who instigated the ongoing U.S. crackdown on illegal immigration, privately have helped to defray Mayorga's legal expenses. We have people coming from everywhere just saying, we'll come and get our oil changed, even if it's that simple, just to keep the shop open, Mays said. Several mechanics who have known Balbino for years have volunteered to work at his shop after their normal work hours, Mays said. The next article is entitled, Gilbert Council Likely to Hike Water Bill Rate, written by Maritza Dominguez. Gilbert Council aims to increase the town's water utility rate up to 25%, a third increase in as many years, despite ongoing outrage from residents about sky-high increases this year and an audit of water billing practices. It's part of an aggressive three-tiered water rate increase plan, the town said it needed to grapple with aging infrastructure and cost escalations. Residential water bills increased by 50% in 2024 and 25% in 2025. The 25% would mean that in 2027, residents would not face an increase, and then in the following 3 years, they would see a 5% increase, said Rebecca Hamel, the town's water manager. Non-residential and landscape accounts would also see the same rate increases as residents, Hamel said. The council will have a second option to consider, which would involve raising rates in 2026 by 14% and again in 2027 by 14%, effectively splitting the 25% increase over 2 years. It would not bring a rate increase in 2028 if the council chooses this option. The town's Public Works Advisory Board, which makes recommendations to the town council, preferred the 25% rate increase. Sam Elliott, the board's chairperson, said in a statement that it best balances short-term affordability for residents with the long-term financial needs of the water system and the continued resiliency of this essential community resource. The December 16th vote was the first step to begin the process, with a final vote planned for February 17th. If the council approves the increase, the rates would then go into effect on April 1st. The increase will be a hit to residents who are already grappling with prior changes. Many have criticized the town's rollout of the rate increases and questioned the bill's accuracy. That pushback pressured the town to launch a water meter audit. At the December 16th meeting, the council approved a contract with Kimley Horn and Associates Incorporated for a contract with a spending budget of nearly $477,000. It will conduct a random sample selection of up to 450 meters, review procedural manuals, audit billing records, and review customer service response time, among other tasks. The firm is expected to provide monthly updates to the town council. That audit is expected to be wrapped up in March. The town additionally plans to increase the solid waste and recycling rates by 2% for residents. Commercial customers could see an increase of between 13% to 24%, depending on the size of their dumpsters. You're listening to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled "Rob Reiner Charged in Parents' Stabbing," written by Brendan Morrow, Tawan Mormon, Kimmy Robinson, and Edward Segarra. After the slayings of acclaimed Hollywood actor-director Rob Reiner and his producer wife, Michelle Singer Reiner, their 32-year-old son, Nick Reiner, briefly appeared in court after prosecutors filed murder charges against him. The acclaimed Princess Bride director and his producer wife were found dead in their Southern California home on December 14th. The family spoke for the first time since then, Wednesday, December 17th, in a statement shared with TMZ and People. Rob and Michelle Singer Reiner's children, Jake and Rami, said, "Words cannot even begin to describe the unimaginable pain we are experiencing every moment of the day. The horrific and devastating loss of our parents, Rob and Michelle Reiner, is something that no one should ever experience," they said in a statement. "They weren't just our parents, they were our best friends. We're grateful for the outpouring of condolences, kindness, and support we received not only from family and friends, but people from all walks of life." The family statement continued, "We now ask for respect and privacy, for speculation to be tempered with compassion and humanity, and for our parents to be remembered for the incredible lives they lived and the love they gave." Alan Jackson, a defense attorney for Nick Reiner, told reporters outside a Los Angeles courthouse Wednesday, December 17th, that his client would be arraigned January 7th after a judge granted his request for a delay. "There are very, very complex and serious issues that are associated with this case," Jackson said. "Things need to be thoroughly but very carefully dealt with and examined and looked at and analyzed. We ask that during this process you allow the system to move forward in a way that it was designed to move forward, not with a rush to judgment, not with jumping to conclusions, but with restraint and with dignity and with the respect that this system and this process deserves and that the family deserves." Jackson, who didn't field questions, has represented numerous other high-profile clients, including Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey. On December 16th, prosecutors filed criminal charges against Nick Reiner, who is accused of fatally stabbing his parents. He fled, but was arrested hours later on the outskirts of downtown Los Angeles, prosecutors said. Reiner faces two counts of murder with the special circumstance allegation of multiple murders and a special allegation that he personally used a dangerous and deadly weapon. Niyama Romani, president of West Coast Trial Lawyers and a former federal prosecutor, told USA Today that the special circumstance of multiple murders entails a mandatory life without the possibility of parole case or a potential death penalty case. Los Angeles County District Attorney Nathan Hochman told reporters December 16th that no decision at this point has been made with respect to the death penalty. "Their loss is beyond tragic," County District Attorney Nathan Hochman said of the Reiners. "We will commit ourselves to bringing their murderer to justice." The felony complaint against the 32-year-old screenwriter was filed in Los Angeles Superior Court about 2:30 p.m. December 16th, hours after Hochman announced in a press conference that his office would be filing charges. "Our office will be filing charges against Nick Reiner, who is accused of killing his parents," Hochman said. "These charges will be two counts of first-degree murder with a special circumstance of multiple murders. He also faces a special allegation that he personally used a dangerous and deadly weapon, that being a knife." In a press release shared with media outlets after the press conference, the prosecutor's office described Nick Reiner as being charged with fatally stabbing his parents, marking the first time officials detailed the couple's death. "The prosecutor's office will take the thoughts and desires of the family into consideration in making our decision about criminal charges," Hochman said. The DA's office alleges he did unlawfully and with malice aforethought murder his parents, Michelle Singer Reiner and Rob Reiner. Nick Reiner, who is the middle child of the couple's three children, remains in police custody with no bail and awaits arraignment. The couple also shared older son Jake Reiner and a daughter, Rami Reiner. Rob Reiner also adopted his first wife, Penny Marshall's daughter, Tracy Reiner. Nick Reiner previously detailed his struggles with drug addiction, which were depicted in a semi-autobiographical film, Being Charlie, co-written by Nick Reiner and directed by his father. The friends' couples are speaking out about their deaths. In a statement shared with the Associated Press on December 16th, Billy Crystal, Martin Short, Albert Brooks, Larry David, and more honored Reiner, 78 years old, as a master storyteller and a passionate, brave citizen, adding that he and Singer Reiner, 70 years old, devoted a great deal of their lives for the betterment of their fellow citizens. Nick Reiner was arrested without incident at Exposition Park near downtown Los Angeles, just south of the University of Southern California campus, around 9 p.m. the previous evening, LAPD Deputy Chief Alan Hamilton said during the December 16th press conference. In a news release shared later in the afternoon, the prosecutor's office alleged that Nick Reiner had fled his parents' Brentwood home before he was arrested. Authorities have made no mention of a possible motive. Asked whether the murder weapon was recovered, Hochman said at the press conference that would be revealed in court. Authorities said autopsies, which have to be completed, would determine the precise cause, manner, and times of death. Various news media outlets have reported that Nick Reiner had a heated quarrel with his parents on December 13th at a holiday party hosted by comedian Conan O'Brien, according to Reuters. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. We'll continue with an article titled, "Bondi Suspect Charged with 15 Murders," written by Scott Murdoch and Alasdair Powell. A man who allegedly opened fire on a Jewish Hanukkah celebration on Sydney's famed Bondi Beach has been charged with 59 offenses, including murder and terrorism, police said on December 17th. The alleged father and son perpetrators opened fire on the celebration at Sydney's famed Bondi Beach on December 14th, killing 15 in an attack that shook the nation and intensified fears of rising anti-Semitism and violent extremism. Funerals for the Jewish victims of the attack began on December 17th, amid anguish over how the gunman, one of whom was briefly investigated for links to extremists, were allowed access to powerful firearms. Sajid Akram, 50 years old, was shot dead by police at the scene, while his 24-year-old son, Navid Akram, emerged from a coma on December 16th after also being shot by police. New South Wales police said on December 17th that a man had been charged with 59 offenses, including 15 counts of murder, 40 counts of wounding with attempt to murder, as well as terror offense and other charges. Early indications point to a terrorist attack inspired by ISIS, a listed terrorist organization in Australia. A court filing on December 17th named Navid Akram, who remains in a Sydney hospital under heavy police guard, as the man charged. He will appear via video link before a local court on December 22nd. The father and son had traveled to the southern Philippines, a region long plagued by Islamist militancy, weeks before the shooting that Australian police said appeared to be inspired by Islamic State. President Donald Trump told a Hanukkah event at the White House late on December 16th that he was thinking of the victims of the horrific and anti-Semitic terrorist attack. "We join in mourning all of those who were killed, and we're praying for the swift recovery of the wounded," he said. The leader of the Australian state of New South Wales said on December 17th he will recall Parliament in the coming days to pass wide-ranging reforms of gun and protest laws, days after the country's deadliest mass shooting in three decades. Chris Minns, the Premier of New South Wales state where the attack took place, told a news conference Parliament would return on December 22nd to hear urgent reforms, including capping the number of firearms allowed by a single person and making certain types of shotguns harder to access. The state government will also look at reforms making it harder to hold large street protests after terror events in order to prevent further tensions. A funeral for Rabbi Eli Schlanger, an assistant rabbi at Chabad Bondi Synagogue and a father of five, was held December 17th. He was known for his work for Sydney's Jewish community through Chabad, a global organization fostering Jewish identity and connection. Schlanger would travel to prisons and meet with Jewish people living in Sydney's public housing communities, Jewish leader Axel Ravchen said December 15th. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is facing criticism that his centre-left government has not done enough to prevent the spread of anti-Semitism in Australia during the Israel-Hamas war. "We will work with the Jewish community. We want to stamp out and eradicate anti-Semitism from our society," Albanese told reporters. The government and intelligence services are also under pressure to explain why Sajid Akram was allowed to legally acquire a high-powered rifle and shotguns used in the attack. The government has already promised sweeping reforms to gun laws. Albanese said Ahmad Al-Ahmad, 43 years old, the man who tackled one of the shooters and suffered gunshot wounds, was due to undergo surgery on December 17th. Al-Ahmad's uncle, Mohammed Al-Ahmad in Syria, said his nephew left his hometown in Syria's northwest province of Idlib nearly 20 years ago to seek work in Australia. "We learned through social media. I called his father and he told me it was Ahmad. Ahmad is a hero. We're proud of him," Syria in general is proud of him, the uncle told Reuters. The family of 22-year-old police officer Jack Hibbert, who was shot twice on December 14th and had been on the force for just 4 months, said in a statement December 17th he had lost vision in one eye and faced a long and challenging recovery ahead. In the face of a violent and tragic incident, he responded with courage, instinct, and selflessness, continuing to protect and help others whilst injured until he was physically no longer able to, the family said. New South Wales Premier Minns said 23 people were still in several Sydney hospitals. Other shooting victims included a Holocaust survivor, a husband and wife who first approached the gunman before they started firing, and a 10-year-old girl named Matilda, according to interviews, officials, and media reports. Matilda's father told a Bondi vigil on December 16th he did not want his daughter's legacy to be forgotten. We came here from Ukraine, and I thought that Matilda is the most Australian name that can ever exist. So just remember the name. Remember her, local media reported him as saying. On Bondi on December 17th, swimmers gathered on Sydney's most popular beach and held a minute's silence. A New Year's Eve party due to be held on the beach was cancelled by organizers. This week has obviously been very profound, and this morning I definitely feel a sense of the community getting together and the sense of everyone sitting together, Archie Califf, a 24-year-old Bondi man, told Reuters. Everyone's grieving. Everyone's understanding and processing it in their own way. The next article is entitled, Winter Viruses Impact Schools and Workplaces, written by Mary Walrath Holdridge. If it seems like everyone is constantly sniffling, sneezing, coughing, or calling out of work, it's likely because the first act of cold and flu season is rearing its ugly head. Common winter illnesses, including COVID-19, influenza, and norovirus, also known as the stomach bug, are circulating in schools, workplaces, and communities across the country. Health agencies like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention use wastewater data collected by measuring the presence of pathogens in water sources such as sewage, industrial waste, and stormwater runoff to monitor illnesses that are spreading and those that are predicted to spread in the future. Norovirus is a highly contagious virus that causes unpleasant gastrointestinal symptoms and is often referred to as the stomach bug or stomach flu, though it is not actually related to the influenza virus. The most common symptoms are nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, stomach cramping or pain, and sometimes fever, headache, or body aches. Wastewater data maintained by Wastewater Scan, a Stanford University-led tool for tracking the spread of disease, reported norovirus activity as being high nationally the week ending December 12th, representing a 42% increase in the median concentration compared to November, which means more of the virus has been detected in the wastewater of more communities nationwide. CDC data through December 6th showed that 9.37% of the 2,722 norovirus tests administered that week were reported as being positive to the National Respiratory and Enteric Virus Surveillance System. The highly contagious disease has been steadily increasing since September, a typical pattern for viruses that spread most widely during colder months. In 2024, wastewater scan data showed norovirus concentrations started to increase in October. Influenza A concentrations saw a dramatic increase of 260% since October, according to wastewater scan data through December 12th. Even so, flu activity is still considered low nationally, according to both wastewater scan and CDC data. CDC data through December 6th showed that 8.05% of the 59,364 flu tests administered that week were reported positive to the surveillance system. In other regions, specifically in Colorado, Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Utah, and Wyoming, that number was as high as over 20%. Some regions in the United States have notably higher flu activity than others. The Northeast and South are now officially considered to be in flu season and have higher concentrations than the rest of the country. As of December 9th, the CDC estimated that COVID-19 infections are growing or likely growing in 22 states, declining or likely declining in 4 states, and not changed in 21 states. Some common symptoms of COVID-19 are fever or chills, cough, shortness of breath or difficulty breathing, sore throat, congestion or a runny nose, new loss of taste or smell, fatigue, muscle or body aches, and headache. Frequent hand washing is one of the most effective ways to keep contagious illnesses at bay, according to the CDC. This applies to these ailments and others that often circulate among the wintertime, like respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV. Health agencies recommend washing hands with hot soapy water for at least 20 seconds. It's also important to wash them before and after eating, before and after handling food, after using the bathroom, and after being around sick people or touching surfaces that could be contaminated. For norovirus, general food safety practices can also prevent a holiday trip to urgent care, the CDC says. Cook food thoroughly and to the designated internal temperature, at least 145 degrees Fahrenheit as a general rule, higher for some foods. Clean and sanitize frequently touched surfaces and objects, especially if they have been in contact with food, and wash fruits and vegetables before serving or eating them. The most effective way to prevent serious illness from flu and COVID-19 is vaccination, according to the World Health Organization, CDC, and other leading medical institutions. Pharmacies are the most common place American adults turn to for seasonal vaccines. CVS and Walgreens, two of the largest chains, offer vaccine appointments online and also accept walk-ins. Both offer the option to receive multiple vaccines at once, and the cost of immunization at these pharmacies is covered entirely by most insurance companies. The next article is entitled, "Palestinians Need More Aid," written by Michelle Nichols. The United Nations and aid groups warned on December 17th that humanitarian operations in the Palestinian territories, particularly Gaza, were at risk of collapse if Israel does not lift impediments that include a vague, arbitrary, and highly politicized registration process. Dozens of international aid groups face deregistration by December 31st, which then means they have to close operations within 60 days, said the UN, and more than 200 local and international aid groups in a joint statement. The deregistration of international aid groups in Gaza will have a catastrophic impact on access to essential and basic services, the statement read. INGOs run or support the majority of field hospitals, primary health care centers, emergency shelter responses, water and sanitation services, nutrition stabilization centers for children with acute malnutrition, and critical mine action activities, it said. While some international aid groups have been registered under the system that was introduced in March, the ongoing re-registration process and other arbitrary hindrances to humanitarian operations have left millions of dollars worth of essential supplies, including food, medical items, hygiene materials, and shelter assistance, stuck outside of Gaza and unable to reach people in need, the statement read. Israel's mission to the United Nations in New York did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Under the first phase of President Donald Trump's Gaza plan, a fragile ceasefire in the two-year-old war between Israel and Palestinian militants Hamas began on October 10th. Hamas released hostages, Israel freed detained Palestinians, and more aid began flowing into the enclave, where a global hunger monitor said in August famine had already taken hold. However, Hamas says fewer aid trucks are entering Gaza than was agreed. Aid agencies say there is far less aid than required, and that Israel is blocking many necessary items from coming in. Israel says it is abiding by its obligations under the truce. The UN will not be able to compensate for the collapse of INGO's operations if they are deregistered, and the humanitarian response cannot be replaced by alternative actors operating outside established humanitarian principles, the statement by the UN and aid groups said. The statement stressed, humanitarian access is not optional, conditional, or political, adding, life-saving assistance must be allowed to reach Palestinians without further delay. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.